Accession number 13459, reel 2.
Every year we have a 10 squadron reunion of the association, and we go up to York and we have a reception, and then we go out to Melbourne, the airfield, and over the years we have paid for a memorial to be built at the entrance to the airfield, which by the way now is a pig farm, and although it still has the hangars and what have you. And the runways.
And your whole crew are still around, aren't they?
I'm in touch with the skipper, the mid-upper gunner, and the navigator. The wireless op, I've never heard of him. Les Bolton, the New Zealand bomb aimer, has died. And my rear gunner, Bill Spate, I've never had contact with him. So there's...
Did they all survive the war?
Oh, yes. So there's... four of us in touch with each other. In fact, I'm going out to New Zealand in January, February of next year to stay with my navigator at Wellington and then go over to Auckland and stay with this Bill Steele that I first started flying with. And while I was at this recent Bomber Command reunion in York in September, I met another New Zealander, Halifax man, who said, good on you, mate, when you're out there, stick a 3 or 4 more days on your holiday and come up and see me. He said, you'd be more than welcome. So it's marvellous after all these years. I haven't seen these people since 1945. It's marvellous after all these years that they will welcome you into their homes. Anyway, I said we'd go to the airfield and we'd lay a wreath at the memorial. And then we would go over to Pocklington, Barmby Moor Village, and lay another wreath there for all the lads of the squadron who didn't survive. They only survived in as much that they came back off a raid and died of wounds and things like that. And there are many, many, many buried in Barmby Moor Cemetery. And now, as I'm much older, it's sad to be at that cemetery and just look at all the headstones. Sergeant so-and-so, pilot 21, Sergeant so-and-so, air gunner 19, and there are dozens and dozens of 20, 19, 21 year olds, all the youth of the country in those cemeteries. And we lay a wreath there, and then in the late afternoon and evening we go by coach to our local pub that we used to use on the outskirts of the airfield. Melbourne's the name of the station, and there is a Melbourne village, but most of us used to use a pub in Seton Ross Village, and its official name is the Blacksmith Arms. It's still the Blacksmith Arms to this day on the sign and over the door. But it was always affectionately known as the Bombers Arms. And to this day, all the villagers who used the pub refer to it as the Bombers. And management, or I guess it's a brewer's pub, different successive managers have tried to get the name changed from the Blacksmith Arms to the Bombers Arms, without success. But we were told at this last reunion in September, authority has been given, and it will, in 1994, its name will be changed to the Bombers Arms. Now, Betty and I went up there, my wife and I went up there a few years ago, and we got to the reunion a couple of days early, because I wanted to drive around and see if I could find my Nissen hut where I was billeted in the woods. Rather ambitious, I suppose, after all these years. Anyway, we drove around, and I couldn't find the Nissen hut. because it had been removed, but I found the concrete pads where all the Nissen huts were bolted. So that gave me a sense of achievement. And then we went to the Bomber's Arms, and I knew exactly where it was, but I wasn't expecting to see a modernised pub, all white, gleaming white, and when we went in, also different from the little grotty pub that we used to use with the spit and sawdust bar and the snug and the and all the rest of it, with the wooden high back settle type seats in the little Yorkshire pubs. It was all modernised with a lovely bar and big windows. And my wife sat in the window looking out, and I went up to the bar, gave my order, and while the order was coming up, there were two or three young lads sat on bar stools, I suppose about 19 or 20. And one of them said to me, "You've been to the Bombers before, sir, haven't you?" And I looked at him and said, "Yes, I had, but many years ago." "I thought so," he said. "There's thousands like you come in here," he said, "and look around." I said, "Well, how did you know that I'd been here before?" "Well, the way you're looking round," he said. He said, "It's obvious." He said, "Thousands come to the Bombers every year," he said, "just like you're doing." And I said, "Now, that's interesting." I said, "How old are you?" "About 20, 21, 22. "Yes," he said. I said, "Well, the pub's called the Blacksmith's Arms. You've just referred to it as the Bombers. Why?" He said, "My granddad calls it the Bombers. I call it, my dad calls it the Bombers," he said, "and we all call it the Bombers, don't we, lads?" Now, after all those years, the pub is still called the Bombers Arms.
Yeah.
And a landlord, about 10 years ago, gave us authority to use one of the back bars as the 10 Squadron Lounge. And all the way around the walls of that lounge are all 10 Squadron photos of crews, of Halifaxes, of wrecks, of crews crawling away from wrecks, sort of thing. We take great enjoyment going back there every year and having a booze up and meeting old comrades. And all swapping stories and things like that. Well, one amusing incident, if I can just say this. A few years ago, my wife and I were sat on the coach going towards the Bombers. And there were two little old ladies sat on the seat in front of me, and I tapped them on the shoulder and I said, "I presume you ladies were WAFs at 10 Squadron, were you? Because the Squadron Association is open not just to air crew, it's open to ground crew, everybody, anyone who was at Melbourne." And I said, "I suppose you were WAFs." "Yes," they said. I said, "Well, what did you do?" "One worked in the flying control, and the other one was an MT driver, a motor transport driver." I said, "What, on crew coaches?" "Yes," she said. I said, "When were you there?" "Oh, 1942 to the end of the war," she said. I said, "Oh, well, you would have probably have driven my crew out to the dispersal for operations." "Well, I might have done," she said, "but I wouldn't know." I said, "Well, I bet you if I told you my skipper's name, you'd remember him." "Oh, no, I wouldn't," she said. I said, "I bet you a pound if I told you my skipper's name, you'd remember him." "No," she said, "I'm a shocker for names. I wouldn't remember him." "What was your skipper's name?" I said, "Georgie Bastard." "Oh, I remember him," she said. "Once heard, never forgotten." So she could have won us half a pound there, but she was reluctant. Anyway, we went on different operations and...
Can I interrupt at this point? Because I'd be very interested to know if you can tell me in detail, if you like, the profile of one particular operation as you remember it. In other words, from the moment, say, that you were on standby or whatever, through the whole procedure that you as a flight engineer experience, all the preparations, how much of your area, like fueling up and things like that, the operation, time over target, returning back.
Mm.
Could you sort of, I know it's perhaps a tall order, but give me, from beginning to end, a typical operation that you can remember.
Well, I did 23 all told. I can't give you exact times of takeoff and things like that.
No, just the typical one.
Well, let's talk about Cologne.
Hang on.
Sorry, have I pulled?
Stop a minute.
Yeah. I want to know about a particular operation. I did 23 ops. I'm looking at my logbook now. Cologne, 2nd of March, 45. Because it's written in green ink, I know that it was a daylight raid. Most of our raids were nighttime, where once you got airborne at dusk and whole squadrons would congregate over Flamborough Head, Yorkshire, and then at the appointed time would all move off across the North Sea in a great big gaggle. And then as it got darker, you would lose sight of a company and aircraft and you were on your own. Although you might be in the middle of 300 or 400 aircraft, you were virtually on your own. The only fact that you knew that other aircraft were with you was by the slipstreams that you felt every couple of minutes. As you run across the back of another aircraft, its slipstream would throw you about. So you took comfort by the fact that you weren't lost. You were still with the rest of the gang. Daylight trips, of course, were different in as much as you could see your own squadron aircraft around you, not in a strict formation, in a gaggle, two or three deep maybe, maybe 500, 1,000 yards on the beam, but all heading in the same direction, but spaced out. And different waves would be at different flight levels. Anyway, that was a daylight trip. So what would have happened there, early in the morning, there would have been, or even the night before, there would have been a tannoy message across the base saying that the following crews are to report to briefing at such and such a time in the morning. And the skipper's names would be read out. And so you would go to briefing. And I don't know what time this Cologne operation took off. But say we went to briefing at 8 o'clock in the morning. And then the briefing officer, the station commander, the operations officer, all the leaders, pilot leader, nav leader, gunnery leader, engineer leader, you'd all be sat there as crews wondering where you were going, and the operations board on the wall was all covered by curtains, and at the appointed time the station commander would pull the cord and the curtains would come back and there would be maps of Europe, and your target was on there by the red tape starting off from Flamborough Head. The red tape would come across the North Sea and inbound over the enemy coast and then maybe go slightly east and then come back southwest and then all different tracks finishing up at the target, and then from the target varying tracks to get you back home again. Never a direct line to the target. It always varied from passing over a different cities to prevent any foresight as to where the target would be, so that enemy fighter squadrons couldn't be positioned at certain places to take you. It was always trying to fool the enemy, I suppose, but I would imagine on most occasions they knew exactly where we were going within about an hour of the briefing. It was
an hour of the briefing?
I would think so, yes, I would think so.
How would they know that?
Well, you had to maintain strict silence of where your target was. It was in your interest. It was in your interest to maintain silence, because you didn't want to alert any espionage or any agents or any messages to get across to say the target is Cologne or Hamburg or wherever it was, because it's not in your interest. But it's surprising how word gets out. And I know that when I've been in York on stand down, we've been in a pub And we've heard the message, oh, the rest of the lads are off to so-and-so tonight. And
Do people talk, or what?
People talk, yes. It is surprising. I mean, everywhere you go during wartime, on railways, on buses, there were posters, careless talk costs lives. But people talk. Even in this modern day, very few people can keep a secret, because there's no fun in having a secret if you know it. The fun of having a secret is saying, look, don't tell anyone else, but do you know that so-and-so and so-and-so is happening, or so-and-so and so-and-so has been arrested for this, that and the other?
So a lot of people on the base actually talked about it in pubs and places.
Yes, yeah. You never actually caught anyone talking about it, but you would hear whispers of where people were going if you were on stand down. On the base, as soon as briefing was declared, all telephones off the base were stopped, so no one could phone off. But there were messages did get out with talk. I can't quote any specific instances, but I have heard people in pubs say, oh, the lads are off to so-and-so tonight then, and you just would give a bland stare and say, oh, don't know about that. But you might have heard on the base from your friends, bloody hell, we're off to Berlin tonight, talking amongst yourselves. But when you hear, when you're in a pub, the lads are off to Berlin tonight then, you would say, well, don't know anything about that. But it was upsetting to know that people knew. Right.
There were agents around listening?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, agents everywhere, aren't there? I mean, in this modern day, how is it that Russia could build an aircraft that we affectionately call the VC-10 ski, which is an absolute replica of a British VC-10, and an aircraft an exact replica of a Britannia? You can't tell me that two aircraft designers in different countries think, oh, I'm going to build an aircraft with four engines on the sponsons at the back under the fin and rudder, and it's going to be this wingspan, and it's going to have that much nose droop, and it's going to contain so many... No two designers could come up with the same thing identical, could they? So espionage has been going on in this country post-war all the way through, and even the most carefully guarded secrets of an aircraft on design, even a passenger carrying an airplane, there are people who've been taking pictures of the blueprints. I mean, and every particular detail of that aircraft to make it identical. Otherwise, they could never get the same, could they? So there are people, even in the highest places, who are taking pictures and sending off information to Russian sources. I mean, in the press, we've heard of the Blunts and all the other people who you would think wouldn't even dream of divulging classified information. But they did, didn't they? And we only know of those who come to light and get arrested, that we found out. I mean, there are thousands and thousands who've never been found out. Anyway, that's digressing.
Back to your Cologne briefing.
Right, back to Cologne briefing. So we would have been briefed, and you would see that you were going to Cologne. The Met man would jump up then and tell you what expected weather would be. Weather forecast for target area is all hit and miss. It was a forecast of what the man expected, but when he's dealing with several hundred miles away, it would only be an estimate. And if you were on a raid, it would be advisable to see the target, and you wouldn't want a target that was covered in 10-tenths cloud, would you? So an aircraft, an early morning mosquito or something like that, would whip across Europe and do a whip round all different places doing Met observations. And then that would all be fed back into the system, and you'd be given the latest information on the weather. layers of cloud to the target, whether the target was expected to be clear on arrival, and all the rest of it. Then the pilot leader would give everyone a brief. Then the nav leader would get up and he would talk to the navs about different courses and expected winds for drift and what have you. Then the engineer leader would get up and give you the fuel load and the bomb load, distribution of bombs, distribution of fuel in the tanks. I mean, we had 7 fuel tanks in each wing, 14 fuel tanks, distribution of tanks, usage of fuel, which tanks to use from, expected endurance of your fuel load on different power settings. Then the gunnery leader would get up and talk about the ammunition for the particular sortie, how many tracer, how many armor piercing and ordinary soft nose bullets in the whole train of the thing. It would all be brief so that each respective man in the crew knew exactly what his part was. And then you'd be told, take off is such and such a time, assemble to get your flying kit at such and such a time. The flight engineer then would leave the briefing and go straight out to his aircraft and do a pre-flight check on his aircraft, discuss the aircraft condition with the maintenance crew, any irregularities with the engines, any magneto drops, any supercharging problems, anything. You'd look through the Form 700, which is the history of the aircraft, and you'd thumb through the pages seeing what rectification and work had been done in the last couple of days. And if the aircraft was to your satisfaction on the document side, then you go out and do a pre-flight and you'd check it all externally. Tire pressures, visual, oleo extensions, hydraulic levels in tanks and reservoirs, and general look round. Nothing broken, obviously broken. Everything, all the cowling secure on the engines. General walk around to see that everything was all sort of shipshape in Bristol fashion. And then you'd go back to the sergeant's mess and have a pre-arranged pre-flight meal, and then you would all assemble, jump into the trucks and go up to the briefing room again and climb into your flying kit. And then at the appointed time, you'd go out to in the crew trucks, and different crews would be dropped off at their respective dispersal where their aircraft was there. And then at the appointed time, you would crank up the engines. There was complete radio silence. Nobody spoke on the radio. It was all done by timing. And at the appointed time, you would taxi out and make your way around the taxi track to the duty runway. And there would be what we called a caravan on the end of the runway, to the side of the runway, and there was a controller in there, and he had his plastic cupola that he would stand in and look out, see each aircraft taxi onto the runway, and you'd open the engines, clear the engines, and he would give you a green on the Aldis lamp. He would just flash a green, which meant you could go. If he flashed a red, you held. You held until you got a green. And when he gave you a green Aldis light, then you just opened up the throttles and went. And then get airborne, make your way across Yorkshire to Flamborough Head, climbing up all the time. And at your appointed rendezvous time and altitude, you would just rendezvous Flamborough Head on a great big circle. And all your squadron mates would all join in on the circle with you, and you'd be going round at about 8,000-9,000 feet, maybe. Another squadron at 10,000-11,000 feet.
Did you have lights on at this stage at night?
No. There was no lights ever. Now, I'm talking about this was a daylight raid on Cologne.
Oh, no, but
yeah, but on a night run, no nav lights. My word, no.
So if you were actually circling, Did anyone ever collide?
We always circled Flamborough Head on a great big circle. I mean, a sort of 15 mile radius. There were no nav lights, and this would always be at dusk, you see, for a night raid, and then set off. And within a short time, it would be dark, and away you'd go. No nav lights, oh, that would be absolutely the height of stupidity, because on one particular raid I was on, when we came back into the circuit, all of a sudden, the radio broke into life. Melbourne aircrafts, they didn't call us Melbourne, they called us Milk Pail. Our call sign was Milk Pail. Milk Pail aircraft, scatter, bandits, which meant German night fighters were in the Yorkshire area. And one of our squadron was actually shot down while he was in the circuit area by enemy intruder night fighters. So you wouldn't have nav lights on. My word, no.
Anyway, you're on your way to Cologne.
Yeah, right? On the way to Cologne on a daylight raid. And the briefing specifically was we were, our particular squadron were going for the bridge over the Rhine. And we were told specifically for the bridge. And we were to hit the bridge. And on the other side of the Rhine, just a short distance away from the bridge, was Cologne Cathedral. And we were told that if we couldn't get onto the bridge because of weather, no definite, clear, visual aiming point for the bridge, we were to carry on until we got to the rail marshalling yards, a massive great railway station. I can't describe it in how many lines or anything, but I would imagine it would be something like Victoria or Paddington, masses of lines, and they were the marshalling yards. And we were briefed specifically, I recall the briefing officer say, if you cannot get the bridge, you are to proceed on to the marshalling yards and go for the marshalling yards. You are at all costs to avoid random dropping of bombs that might hit the cathedral. And that was a specific point on that raid. In later years, I went back to Cologne, and to my knowledge, I don't think any bombing raid on Cologne, and Cologne was absolutely decimated. At the end of the war, it was decimated. But the twin spires of that cathedral still stood. Now, to this day, there are great big flakes of masonry stonework off the outside of the cathedral with bomb splinters that have taken chunks off. But to my knowledge, nothing ever penetrated any bombs, which is remarkable, really, as Cologne Cathedral is right in the middle of the city, unlike Coventry and places like that, and Bristol. Bristol churches by the dozen got bombed and burned down at Bristol. Now, all the way over to the target, as you went over different towns and cities, of course, the ACAC would be coming up at you. Fighter aircraft would be about, trying to pick off stragglers. They wouldn't come into the middle of the mainstream. You rarely saw an enemy fighter in daylight. I think because they themselves would be too visible a target. Night flying, fighters would be in and out of the stream using their radar, picking off aircraft and then disappearing and then coming back in and picking off another one. Anyway, we dropped our bombs and on the bridge area, and then once I would think the most exciting... No, that's not the right word. The most harrowing time would be once the bomb aimer has said, target sighted, left, 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 steady, steady. On the bombing run now, skipper, steady, steady, left, left, steady, 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 steady. And as his voice gradually, the tempo st- steady, 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 bomb's gone. As soon as he hit the bomb release button, and about 8,000 or 10,000 pounds of bombs were released, the aircraft actually lifted, and the aircraft surged upwards, and then the power would go on, and the skipper knew the outward bound heading, 270 or 280 or something like that, and he would turn on that heading and homeward bound. And then it's all fingers crossed to hope that you get home.